the way you might test something at scale is you have to implement it at scale and then find out if it works. That's a really scary and really expensive thing to do.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. In one of our recent episodes, we spoke to Robert Jenkins from UNICEF about what he called the global learning crisis. We made that the title of our episode. And also the global commitment to solve the problems in education. One of the problems he identified is the difficulty of taking what we learn in RCTs and applying it to many schools, maybe in many countries. Adrienne Lucas at the University of Delaware is one of the authors of a paper that tells the story of an experiment that applied and compared four ways to increase learning at scale. And she joins me now. Adrienne, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
We're really pleased to have you for this. You so rarely hear about this type of research. As Robert told us,
I think we have to be careful not to go down the trap of piloting in small scale and research of only small numbers of schools or small numbers of children when we have an at-scale crisis.
Do you agree with him that we have a crisis at the moment and that we need to show that our best practices can work at scale?
Absolutely. I think we have evidence from many contexts that while the crisis of getting students into school has largely been solved, they're not learning while they're in school. So what that means is students are progressing from grade level to grade level, and maybe they're not going to graduate because they don't have the right competencies, or they're just multiple years behind grade level. So for example, we have evidence from Ghana that by the time someone's in third grade, maybe they can't even recognize their letters. And this is what has been coined by the World Bank, among others, as the learning crisis, right? Students are in school, which is obviously an important step one, but they're just not learning. And so in terms of the best practices, the children are the future. And it may be cliche to say that, but if you have an entire generation of individuals who don't have the basic numeracy and literacy to be productive members of society, then really we're leaving behind millions and millions of children.
We have lots of encouraging RCT results about how we improve education. We regularly cover them on Vox Dev Talks. But why might these experimental results not show up when we scale up?
So I think there are three big reasons why they might not show up. The first one is scale is just really, really big. Mm-hmm. When you think about a school-based intervention, it's one thing to develop a teacher handbook and teacher training for 100 schools. It's a very different thing to think about trying to just physically transport and print materials for tens of thousands of schools and teachers and train them. And so the first aspect is scale is just really, really big. So can it even get to the person who's supposed to be implementing the program? I think the second reason is that experiments can sometimes happen on a very specific context. So maybe this worked in a small rural school, but is it going to work in a big urban school? Or this worked in the northern part of a country, which may have different cultural norms than the southern part of a country. Those first two, they're not easy to solve, but we can think about how to solve them. We can improve printing capacity, or we can think about running experiments across different settings. But I think the bigger issue and the third aspect is that it's implementation quality. Most of the experiments are run by people like me who are really involved researchers or a non-governmental organization where there is someone who is taking care of everything from the largest detail, which is, you know, is the material printed, to the smallest detail of what happens when a trainer is out sick. There's someone who's keeping track of all these problems and making sure that the experiment goes as perfectly as possible because that is their focus. When we think about a government system, we're asking people who are already doing hundreds of different things. They don't have that singular focus on this particular project. And so what happens when things are implemented in government systems at scale is they typically lack this really focused researcher or really focused non-governmental organization, making sure it exactly replicates the design of the program that happens successfully in a small scale.
So ideally, to solve some of these problems, or to find out how to solve some of these problems, you set up a trial at scale. It's very easy for me to say that. I assume this is not a very easy thing to do. What are the practical problems in setting up an at-scale trial?
To know if something works in a government system, you have to work in the government system. And that can often be a very challenging thing to do. So first of all, governments are not always excited about experimentation. They want to know what works and they want to implement what works, or they want to implement something that's going to get them political points and they want everyone to have it and they want them to have it yesterday. Mm-hmm. And so part of it is thinking about the hesitancy of governments to rigorously test ideas. And the way you might test something at scale is you have to implement it at scale and then find out if it works. That's a really scary and really expensive thing to do. And so the approach that we took is we implemented as if it had been at scale, but did it on a little bit smaller scale. And I think that's really the future of thinking about what might work at scale, is replicate all of the issues you might have. So use the existing systems, use the existing distribution, the existing personnel, but you can still evaluate it in an experimental setting like we did, looking at 500 schools, which is clearly not the entire country of Ghana, but it's a lot larger than we see in some settings.
Does this gap that we're talking about here, this lack of at-scale trials, does it have a chilling effect on policy? There's some things that you might suspect would be amazing if they were implemented, but we'll just never find out. So no policymaker can really sign off on them.
I don't know if I'd call it a chilling effect on policy, because policies are being implemented, but I think you're right in that it maybe isn't the right policies that are being implemented. So the lack of evidence, I think, is preventing policymakers from making, we talk about the best buys, or maybe making the most effective decision. Policy is being made, but I think there's room certainly for there to be more evidence to inform that policy.
Let's talk about your research. This follows an at-scale trial. As you say, it's not a whole country, but it's a lot bigger than most trials that happened in Ghana. So how did it come about?
So this is really Annie and Jessica's story. So these are my co-authors, and I wish they were here to tell it. I will attempt to tell their story. This builds on a series of studies that came out of India that were implemented by a large Indian NGO called Pratham. And then some additional evidence that was coming out of Kenya. Policymakers in Ghana were aware of this learning crisis, and they wanted to increase learning for their students, and they wanted to know how to do it. And so one of the first things that happened was that Annie took a contingent from the Ghanaian government to Pratham in India to meet the Indian NGO and also see how it was implemented in schools in India. The idea that they saw in that Pratham implements in India is concept of teaching at the right level. And teaching at the right level is to divide students by their learning level instead of their grade level for part of the day. And so with the idea of focusing on specific students, the policymakers come back to Ghana and make this a Ghanaian version of what they had observed in India. So they were interested in two of the models that Pratham advocates in India. One of them is an after-school remedial program using assistance. One of them is a during-school program that uses assistance. The government was also curious, though, to think about, is this about just a smaller class size, or is this really about this remedial content? And so another intervention they were interested in is a smaller class size intervention. Finally, there was at the time this youth employment program that was used for the assistance. A concern was, can that be sustained? And could we just get the same effects if we only use the teachers? And so the final arm tries to do what the assistants do, but have it using just the existing teachers. And so that's how we come up with this integration of the research and the policymakers in the program.
Yes, I'm going to ask you about how those work on the ground in a second. But first of all, I want to find out about the scale of the commitment, what the Ghanaian government committed to. How big was this trial? How long did it last? What ages did it cover?
It was 500 schools. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to have five different treatment arms, 100 schools per treatment arm. And they were spread countrywide. That was an important consideration, is we didn't want this to be only rural, only urban. And so it pulls from all 10 regions at the time from Ghana. The study was 3 school years. So we first interact with the students in year one, and the final interaction with them is in year three. And during that whole time, they should have been receiving the program. The students that we follow in the paper are grade one when we first see them. And so they're on average about 7.5 years old. And we follow them for 2 years until they should have been in grade three. To provide some additional evidence, we also start students who are in grade two at the beginning of the program, and then we follow them through the end of grade four.
Right. So we're covering foundational learning, that really important time where kids learn the things that is going to mean that they can carry on with their education. These 4 interventions, you said, first of all, there are sort of what you call remedial pullout lessons, after school lessons. What happens when you have this kind of help for kids?
Both of these 2 interventions involved assistants. The schools were directed to recruit these assistants among secondary school graduates from their communities. The assistants should have had a secondary school degree, and they end up being about 25 years old. And the assistants are then paid by the National Youth Employment Program, which is a Ghanaian program at the time. Once these assistants are hired, they're centrally trained, and they're trained on remedial pedagogy and ways to teach students who are below their grade level. They then go into the schools, and they tested students to figure out the students' learning level. There's 3 learning levels, 1, 2, and 3. Mm-hmm. And students who are learning levels 1 and 2 were considered remedial. So in the pullout remedial, an assistant would take the learning level 1 students, for example, and meet with them outside of the classroom, but during the regular school day. The after school remedial is a similar model, but instead of the student leaving the regular classroom during the day, they would ask to stay after school to work with that assistant on similar content, but after school.
Now, for smaller class sizes, give us numbers on this. What are we talking about? How did you achieve it?
The smaller class sizes uses the same assistant hiring plan, but then this assistant, instead of working with, as I used an example, level 1, they were to take half of the class and work with them outside of the normal class. This was during a time not when new material was being introduced in the classroom, but reviewing material that had previously been introduced. Our average class size is about 36. And so this would reduce a 36-student classroom to 18, with 18 working with the teacher and 18 working with the assistant. And they were to select a different 18 every day. So it wasn't always that the assistant had the same 18 students. They were to select different students so that the students would benefit both from the assistant and from the classroom teacher, but in a smaller setting.
As you said, the final intervention doesn't use a teaching assistant, does it? It's called a partial day tracking. How does this work then?
Partial day tracking, you're correct. There's no assistance in this. This is only using the classroom teachers. The classroom teachers got the same training that the assistants did in terms of thinking about remedial content. They also received training on how to divide students by learning level as the assistants did. And the way it was implemented in the classroom changed partway through the program. So at the beginning of the program, teachers were told to divide their students by learning level within their individual classroom, but focus their attention on 1 learning level at a time. Anyone who has interacted with a group of 7.5-year-olds is going to understand that 36 7.5-year-olds, when you're telling 2/3 of them to do their own thing, is not going to be maybe the most successful program.
Difficult, yes.
We heard that from teachers. So a few months into the program, the method in which students were taught by their learning level changed. And so what then happened was teachers of grades 1, 2, and 3 divided the students across the grade levels into learning levels for part of the school day. And 1 teacher was in charge of each learning level. You would have an entire classroom of learning level 1s, an entire classroom of learning level 2s.
For those 3 interventions which required teaching assistants, that must have been quite a lot of teaching assistants. Where did you find them all?
There was more people applied than were hired. So they applied directly to the school, and it was up to the school management committee in conjunction with the head teacher and maybe a parent and maybe a teacher to interview and select the assistants. And from what we understand, there was no problem. Every school was able to hire an assistant, and they were told to be mostly secondary school graduates. And I think over 90% of the assistants who were eventually hired were secondary school graduates. They're about 25 years old on average, and about 40% were women.
What results did you get?
We collected a lot of data. I'm going to focus on the results that are the achievement results from academic year three, so the final time we see the students. And a shameless plug to go read the paper. We have a lot more results in the paper, so go check it out and see what some of the other results are.
This is one where I ask a very short question, which could have a very long answer. Thank you for summarizing.
Right. So in academic year three, right, these are students who started the program in grade one and should be grade three when we see them. When we average across all the interventions, remember, we've talked about these four different interventions that we had. There's also a control group. Our last 100 schools got nothing. So we're going to compare the four treatments to business as usual. And so relative to the business as usual, the average effect across the four treatments is about 11% of a standard deviation. That's about a third of a year of learning. So students got the program for a little over 2 years. And so it's an extra third of a year of learning with a 2-year exposure to the program. We can focus on foundational content, and the effects are a little larger, not surprisingly, because of the focus on remedial.
Mm-hmm.
We can also look separately across each intervention, and all four of them separately have positive effects on test scores. And we can rank the effect sizes from the largest. So the largest is after-school remedial, which is about 14% of a standard deviation, and then pull-out remedial, and then classroom split, and then partial day tracking, and the partial day tracking effect is about 8% of a standard deviation. And again, taking this to years of learning, it's about 34% to 19% of a year of learning.
So these are encouraging results. Some children getting a particular benefit, and are the effects that you get, the positive effects, preserved afterwards?
Everybody benefits. Mm-hmm. The girls benefited a little more than boys in the remedial and in the tracking arms.
Okay.
This is a bit of a puzzle. One thing that we thought maybe is role model effects, but it's not that, because it's not that the assistants were more likely to be women than the classroom teachers. Actually, 40% of the assistants were women and 50% of the teachers were women. Our hypothesis is that girls may have felt more comfortable in a setting in which their peers had a more similar learning level to theirs. Mm-hmm. In terms of persistence, we look at students who aged out of the program at the end of grade three, and we test them again in grade four, and we find that the effects persist into grade four.
That one thing we mentioned right at the beginning was the problem of when you're working at scale, making sure everyone's doing what you really want them to do when you're not in touch with them day to day. It must have been extremely hard within this at scale trial to have any control at all over what teachers and the assistants are doing. Was this a problem for you?
Well, it depends on how you define the word problem. I mean, part of the design of the program was for people to do what they were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we learned a lot about what they were going to do. And it wasn't always exactly what the program had intended them
yeah.
to be doing. What we did, though, is we wanted to make sure we understood this. So I alluded to this massive data collection. We collected 6 rounds of what we called spot checks. We visited the school when they should have been doing one of the interventions to see, were you doing it? And the way we defined, were you doing it, is we wanted to know, are the students working with the assistant as they're supposed to be, or are they divided by learning level as they're supposed to be? And the answer is sometimes. So you're completely right. Teachers and assistants did what they were going to do, and it maybe wasn't exactly what they had been told to do. In the teacher arm, they were only actually dividing students by learning level about 6% of the time.
Oh.
Yeah, really low.
Gosh.
And in the assistant arms, they were doing it more. They were doing it about 30 to 40% of the time.
Okay. In a perfect world, if you had complete compliance, where what you wanted with the interventions was just the way that education was done, what do you think the effects would have been?
We can't really know for sure. None of them were implemented 100% correctly, so we don't know, but we can estimate. We can use what economists call an instrumental variables approach, but the intuition is we try to scale the approach using some statistics to figure out what if it was implemented 100% of the time. Based on these estimates, we think that would be about 43% of a standard deviation, or about an entire year of learning.
Yeah.
So if these programs were implemented with 100% fidelity over these 2 years, we think students would have likely gained an extra year of learning.
Adrienne, this is really exciting. It's really positive results that you have from this. But can we say from the research that you've done here, which of these interventions is best? And I guess also that phrase that you used early on, which of them's the best to buy?
If you take the point values literally, like we talked about earlier, how you can rank each program by its exact point value, the largest effect size is for the after-school remedial, but that's only a little bit higher than the pullout remedial.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of best buys, I immediately think about cost-effectiveness. So, you know, for each dollar you spend, how much learning are you going to get? Well, the assistant arms are the most expensive because you have to pay an assistant salary. Whereas if you're using existing teachers, their salaries are part of the normal school operations. It turns out on a per pupil basis, the assistant arms are about twice as expensive as the teacher arms, but the assistant remedial arms are about twice as effective as the teacher arms. When you think about cost per unit of learning, those all come out as about the same, but the classroom split comes out worse.
I think I'm right in saying that there have been other large-scale experiments in improving education, haven't there, that have had less encouraging results. So what's made the difference in this case, do you think?
I'm not sure I would characterize them not having positive results. It's a lot about implementation quality.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been plenty of large-scale studies with assistants who had very strong incentives to do a good job, because if they didn't, they would not get renewed. And those tend to be successful. And so here, our implementation was not as high as you would have liked. But even though, as I said, we only see teachers doing this about 6% of the time, they're taking elements that they learned in the pedagogy training and they're using it in other aspects of their teaching. I think what makes a difference here is two things. One, this is a very successful program when it's implemented with full fidelity.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though this was implemented imperfectly, given how successful the potential of this program is, we still had positive effects.
Yeah. And as you say, it's learning exactly what you can achieve in the real world. One of the interesting things that's come out of this, you say these methods are now being applied elsewhere. Where, and are there similar results to applying it elsewhere?
So the big place we think of when we think of differentiated learning is Pratham and their work in India across multiple states in India. I'm actually working with the government of Ghana in thinking very carefully about this teacher arm, because they're very interested in using existing personnel to improve student learning. With some other co-authors, we're thinking about how to scale this up to 10,000 schools in Ghana.
Wow.
And so, shameless plug for my next paper, we would love to come back and talk more about what we're finding with that paper.
Absolutely.
The importance of using the head teachers and using the school supervisors to think about increasing that fidelity of implementation from 6% to more. We're also doing some exciting work in Ghana and thinking about how to maintain this in a cost-effective way, because in-service teacher training is very expensive. Beyond Ghana, I think there are about 17 different African countries who are looking at different models of this, whether it's the teacher-based or the assistant-based, and differentiating teaching to teach learners where they are, not under some idealized, you know, you're in third grade, you should be here, but thinking about increasing student learning to get them to grade level or closer to grade level.
But there's always a but. Since this experiment, there has been probably the biggest challenge to the development of education that we have seen in recent years. COVID, the mess that it has left in its aftermath and how disruptive it was to schooling. Are you optimistic or pessimistic that the gains that you and other researchers have been making recently can be preserved, can be built on?
I have a paper that accidentally answers this question. We had done an intervention where we were thinking about using the head teachers and the supervisor structure, and the experiment was over, and we had tested the students, and we found positive effects. And then COVID hit. We had enough funding to go back after schools reopened and after COVID to retest the students who had been in the original experiment. These are students, older students. They had graduated from elementary school into junior high school. They had been subject to school-related COVID closures. And after all of that, we still find that the students that had been treated with differentiated learning, their learning gains persisted even in the post-COVID period. COVID flattened everyone's learning trajectory, but our students who had this stronger foundation had higher learning 2 years after the end of the intervention through the COVID closures. Providing students with a strong base can act as a buffer against any sort of schooling challenge that they're going to experience, whether it's COVID or a climate-related disaster that causes them to miss school or a conflict. Giving them the stronger base helps them have more learning later.
Adrienne, thank you.
Thank you. This has been wonderful.
You will want to read the paper to fill in all the things that we haven't been able to talk about. It is called Experimental Evidence on 4 Policies to Increase Learning at Scale. And the authors, Annie Duflo, Jessica Kiesel, and Adrienne Lucas. It was published in the Economic Journal, February 2024. And remember also, if you want to listen to our Vox Dev Talk with Robert Jenkins, it's called The Global Learning Crisis. And we put that out on the 17th of April. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. And our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where you will also find articles about the topics we feature.